Good evening. Thank you for joining me on the Vigilance Press podcast. My name is James Dossie, and I'll be hosting tonight. We're doing a little roundtable discussion on campaign creation, and I have two very special guests tonight. I have Jason Tondro, also known as Dr. Comics. Jason, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. And also, we've got Christopher CSA Badass McLaughlin.
Shh, secret identity.
So, Christopher, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great, sir. How are you?
Oh, fine, fine. How are the dogs?
Oh, sleepy. They've eaten their dinner. Their work is done for today.
Cool. So, before we jump into the discussion, just to give people a little background, Christopher has done, I want to say, at least a third of the books that Green Ronin is published for Mutants and Masterminds.
Really?
Maybe not that many. Wow. I don't know.
Well, let's stick with that. I like the sound of it.
You've put out a lot, especially you've put out several of the Age books, and you've done some of the infamous Noir book that we always have to mention now.
Yes, because you know, nothing starts off a podcast like a good crying joke.
But actually, what you've got coming up is a bit more exciting for me. I really am looking forward to it. I hate having to wait till next year, but the Emerald City source book is just really exciting sounding.
Well, thank you, thank you. I love what I've seen so far. This is one of those where I truly, truly looking forward to getting this out to the people, because I think they're going to love the results.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and to be clear, you didn't write the whole thing, but you did contribute to a significant part of the book.
That's correct. It's a book about a fictional city in the Pacific Northwest. So they went out and they hired me, who has lived his whole entire life in the South, and they went and got native New Englander Steve Kenson to write the other third of it. And then we figure, you know, who's going to know the American Pacific Northwest better than an Australian guy? So he wrote the rest of the book. So we're thinking, you know, you're going to be able to smell the forest on this one. It's so authentic, so well researched, and
maybe it's like a triangulation strategy. Like, you know, you draw lines; they all intersect in Seattle.
There you go. Now you said or Australian. Who are we talking about?
You know something, I had 2 hours of sleep last night. I'm drawing a total blank on this guy's name. I'm going to have to spend all day tomorrow apologizing to him because I could tell you how awesome his stuff is and how really good it is and how he was writing stuff like about the Emerald City Police. And, you know, and you never would guess his national origin for it. It's well done and so professionally done. And I can tell you everything but his name.
Okay. Well, glossing over that.
I'm so
really
embarrassed.
Really quickly. That's okay.
We know what you'll be doing tomorrow.
Apologizing. Yes. Totally apologizing.
So, quick question. To round out the introductions, jumping back to Jason.
Sure.
You are a student of superheroes, a scholar, and a gentleman.
I have the very good fortune to teach superheroes and superhero comics at the University of California, Riverside, where I've been teaching comics for about a year now in the English department there.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I have, like, the second best job in the world. I mean, if I was actually making the comics, that would probably be cooler. But if I can't make them, I can't imagine getting much better than what I've got.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So you've also published a book recently, Superheroes of the Round Table.
Yeah. It's this grew out of my PhD dissertation, which was on comics and medieval and Renaissance lit. And the basic argument is that superhero comics and these medieval and Renaissance texts, I'm talking about things like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales or Beowulf or Spenser's poem The Faerie Queen or Shakespeare's plays like Tempest or Hamlet, that these texts have a lot more in common than we think. And I'll mm-hmm. just give one example to kind of give an idea of what I'm talking about. Whenever the great superheroes of the world get together, whenever the Avengers get together, whenever the Justice League gets together, they always sit down at a
round table.
Oh, yeah. Right? Why is it always a round table? And how come the Fantastic Four don't get a round table, and the Teen Titans, they don't get a round table. Only the world's greatest superheroes get the round table, right? And so I, using things like this, I try to talk about the connections between these books and how not only can we use, not only can we can read superhero comics smarter if we've read Beowulf and Tempest and Fairy Queen. We can do the opposite, actually. We can also use comics like, say, Jack Kirby's Fourth World books or Iron Man or Grant Morrison's Seven Soldiers of Victory or his Invisibles to help us understand the medieval texts, to help us understand Malory's Morte Arthur, or to help us understand Fairy Queen. And that's basically the book, I mean, in 5 minutes.
Well, now we saved everybody a bunch of money. Now, but seriously, so you two guys, you know, top of my very short list of who I'd want to bring on to talk about the subject tonight. We're basically talking about, in particular, superhero comics, but in general, campaign creation for role-playing games. And this is an approach that I use for my Mutants and Masterminds, or not an approach, but this is the kind of thing I do when I'm getting ready for a Mutants and Masterminds campaign or any other campaign, really. It's for me, it's kind of a universal thing, but you know, everyone else's mileage may vary, but I kind of break it down. My approach is similar to, you know, how you might approach like creating a TV series or a book or something, where I kind of start off with, you know, certain details and then move forward. You know, usually the first thing you want to tackle is figuring out what genre you want to run in, right? I mean, this is pretty much, if you're going to run a superhero game, you want to determine if it's going to be like gritty and Iron Age and other different superhero ages, like the Silver Age. I think Christopher McLaughlin's a little bit familiar with.
I'll be it.
Chris, how do you start a superhero campaign? How do you start planning that?
Well, I try to do two things. You first of all have to answer two fundamental questions. First of all, you have to ask yourself, what are my players expecting?
Yeah.
You see, because one of the great, great kept secrets of role-playing is it's all about the players.
Yeah.
No matter how big your shield is, no matter how tightly constructed your plot lines are, the ultimate test is how happy are your players.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you really have to have a sense of what your audience is looking for. And you know, myself, I was blessed with players that were willing to try anything and everything. But let's face it, you know, there are a lot of groups out there that, you know, if you're not giving them thinly veiled X-Men stories, you're not going to be happy. And, you know, at the end of the day, you ultimately just have to write for that audience or move on to something else.
No, you're right. I think it's very much a kind of writer-audience sort of relationship there. You know, let's face it, we can write whatever we want, but if the audience isn't enjoying it, then we essentially
Totally.
Yeah. The difference, that is the main difference between what we're doing and like creating a work of art that basically doesn't exist until the audience sees it. We're actually participating with the audience to create something. You know, it's almost more like we take on the role of an editor or a producer more so than a writer. You know, I think we want to work with the players as much as possible. So I do try to invite them to contribute a lot, but when I'm starting off, I basically have my pitch that I want to put together, and it'll usually give me, you know, I'll usually have something that'll be a generalized idea of what the setting's like and the themes that I'm shooting for, and that'll kind of how I introduce the idea to the players and see what their reaction is.
And you know, I'm sorry. You just made me think a big thought. I have to share. Maybe it's your
please.
Academicness that's rubbing off on me. Well, you know, you got me thinking about how, having written, you know, some role playing adventures that have I've been blessed enough to be published on them.
Yes.
You know, if you look at what's going on in our popular culture now, we're kind of in the age of the mashup. You know, it's the, hey, look what I did with this old Muppet footage superimposing Doctor Who dialogue on it.
Yeah, yep.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a relatively recent thing. But if you think about it, the people that have been writing role-playing stuff, we may have been the very first creative artists who knew going in that everybody was going to be doing essentially a mashup of what we create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when I write an adventure, I mean, I'm obviously trying to do the best job I can, but, you know, there's always this thought in the back of my head that, you know, no matter how hard I work on this, everybody is going to buy this and just take whatever bits fit their campaign and mix it in with the stew of whatever their campaign is like. I mean, Time of Vengeance, for example, one of the proudest, if not the proudest thing I've ever written. There's a guy on the Atomic Think Tank who back converted it to a World War II Golden Age adventure. And from the sound of things, worked brilliantly. Nothing I would have ever thought of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But there you go. I mean, you know, yeah. Those of us who create this sort of thing, we go in knowing we're just going to wind up in somebody, we're going to wind up in 100, if we're lucky, different mashups of what we actually tried to create.
Yeah, yeah. When I could give you another example, but you already named one. Didn't you do Time of Crisis?
I did.
Yeah. The biggest M&M campaign I ever ran was an online mush. Do you guys know what mushing is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So I was the lead writer, the lead GM for Crucible City Mux, which was, I believe, the only M&M mush ever. At least, they made a sequel. After I left, the gamers made a sequel, but I was the lead GM for about a year, and we had hundreds of players on that game.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was set in an alternate sort of version of Chicago where like a third of the city had been blown up in this sort of mysterious accident, which had also conveniently killed like almost all the superheroes on Earth. And
it's
so,
like Brave New World.
Yeah. Well, it was really done just to create a need for new heroes. It was like, okay, all the old heroes are gone, and this creates a power vacuum so that we can keep the spotlight on the player characters. I didn't come up with the background. I was like the guy that came in to sort of run the game and get it running, but I didn't create the premise, I should say. Well, anyway,
okay.
About 6 months or so going in, we decided to have a big event, and I said, okay, well, let's do Nazis Invade from Another Timeline, because you can't go wrong with Nazis. You know, you can never have too many Nazis, was my slogan at the time. And I went back to Time of Crisis, and I pulled all of the, like, evil Nazi super intelligent cyber tanks and planes and stuff and ripped them right out of your adventure, and I dumped them into this game along with, I think I must have written up 24 additional antagonist character sheets, and some of them were Nazi werewolves, and some of them were super submersibles, but whatever. And then we just threw all of these bad guys out openly and let all the players pick them up and run fight scenes on their own inside the game.
Wow.
Yeah. So we just dumped all of these bad guys on them, and within minutes, people were starting to run the Nazi invasion on the streets of this city. And all I had to do was stand back and watch. And it was awesome. It was like 2 months of awesome sauce. And all the players were their own GMs, and they all just sort of played out this Nazi invasion. And anyway, so, and this is a long example, but I did exactly what you're talking about with your book. I didn't want to run Time of Crisis because I had 100 players. But I could pull all the stuff that I could use out of it,
mm-hmm.
and then add a bunch of my own stuff, and then just leave all the tools on the table, knowing that the players would make whatever they wanted out of those tools. So they basically made a mashup of my mashup. And it worked out. It worked out really well.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, now I have to give my Time of Crisis story, because mine is fortunately shorter because it doesn't require as much setup, but or you know, there isn't the technical explanation there, but of the mush, but although I am considering trying to start a mush or actually a muck, but similar concept.
Yeah, same thing.
I just, you know, the time consideration is a factor right now for me. But
when you decide to open that game or build that game, you call me.
I will. I'll definitely email you. I mean, we've kind of got the server and everything set up. It's just a question of getting the players and the writing started. But when I first picked up Mutants and Masterminds, we kind of fooled around with it for a little bit. But it wasn't until I picked up Time of Crisis and ran that for my players that everything kind of clicked for them. About, you know, and the numbers and the rules kind of disappeared, and they really jumped into the setting and they really bought into the storyline. You know, again, talking about the mashup approach, I did discard one of the chapters and replaced it with a different setting when I ran it. And it wasn't because I didn't like the settings that Christopher had written. I just wanted to do something, you know, that was a little me.
Yep.
So I kind of, I kind of threw in, I don't, you know, I'm trying to remember because I've actually run the module a couple of times now, and I don't remember which one I got rid of the first time, but I replaced it with like giant robots had taken over the world, and the heroes had to fight these giant robots. So, you know, it was kind of this big post-apocalyptic fight scene with, you know, giant Japanese robots. But because, you know, I'm a big anime fan. But the thing was that when it came down to that final knockdown drag out fight with Omega, the players had each, you know, had a couple of turns trying to make different characters, but I basically let them bring in multiple characters to really make it a huge epic battle with like a dozen or so superheroes fighting against Omega, and it established and firmly cemented that campaign because that villain was so enduring, and the scenario had really captured their imaginations. That was that was my longest running Supers campaign for, you know, since I moved to Atlanta, I think. You know, so that one it really kicked in, and you know, anytime I'd run a campaign, they would always want it to be in that setting so that even if they didn't play the same characters, they would always know that that moment happened in the story. So
I found, you know, you're absolutely right. That idea that there's context, that is that your characters are part of an ongoing story, that there's been a world before you and that there are things moving even when you're not looking at them.
Yes.
This is the same thing that writers try to create. You know, when Busek writes Astro City, he's trying to create a whole world, or at least give the impression of a whole world, without actually doing all the creation part. Right? So he'll just name drop characters and hint at what they're doing, or hint at some significant event in their past. And it works for that book. It helps us feel like there's this whole world out there, and that's what your players are craving, and that it's made all the better because they know that they were part of it.
Right. And the key is learning, you know, it's kind of like, I like to use the analogy of an old backlot movie set where you're trying to set up enough that you can create the illusion of a living, breathing world, but you don't have to build a whole world. You just have to build the front of the buildings. You know, you have to build what people are going to see and, you know, and what you expect to, you know, them to interact with, but you don't necessarily have to write, you know, you don't necessarily have to write Freedom City, like an entire book of it. I mean, fortunately there are people out there who've already done this for us, but but you know, it was I was kind of looking at the Atomic Think Tank, and I remember somebody was going, well, how would you start writing something like Freedom City? And I would basically say I'd go buy Freedom City. You know, I'm a writer and an artist. I'm a very creative person, and I love to put my own stamp on things. But, you know, at the end of the day, the most important thing for me is creating a scenario where the players feel like they're in a city and they're in a setting. And that's really more important than actually the accomplishment of trying to, you know, write enough details so that my players actually know what radio stations are available, you know.
Well, at the same time, though, if the guy asks, how do you write Freedom City? I mean, we're obliged to find him a good answer.
Exactly.
Right?
So that, you know, the genesis of this, it was basically the idea of pulling you guys together. It was really to sit and think about, well, how do you approach, you know, your normal games? What how much detail do you try to put into it at first blush? And then, you know, where do you go from there? So, you know, for me, when I start writing a campaign, it really comes down to, you know, I sketch out the ideas that I want for the setting. I want, you know, a certain mood or a certain, you know, look to things. I may have some neat sci-fi ideas that I want to build a story around, like, you know, a technology that may drive the whole storyline of the game. But, you know, usually it's I'm just grabbing for loose, you know, something to kind of illustrate to my players what the setting is like. And again, the mashup idea comes in, because I'll tell you, the easiest way to go to your players and say, this is the kind of campaign I want to run, is to go like this, but this.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the X-Men, but with a, but you guys are actually, you know, Teen Titans or something, you know, or something where you can give them something that they're familiar with and they'll instantly know what kind of characters they can make.
Yeah.
So having something that you can do that with, it's a lot harder, I think, to start with a setting that they would never have seen before, or that isn't like something they've seen before. Mm-hmm. So it's really helpful, I think, to start with something that you all have a common ground with. Have you ever tried to do a game setting where you felt like your players just didn't know what you were trying to get across when you were pitching it to them or sitting down with them?
Well, I can answer your question in a roundabout sort of way. I wanted to get in my second big question before we drift too far away from origin campaigns.
Yeah, I've been waiting for that, actually.
But to me, as a pretty much full-time game master, the second big question to me was after, you know, is this something my players are actually going to be interested in? The second thing that I think, you know, sometimes you can lose sight of in that initial burst of enthusiasm is, how excited am I really about this idea? And I think the best way to test yourself on that is, okay, I've got the first adventure. What's the second?
Yeah,
what's the third?
Right.
What's the fourth? You know, see how long it takes before you exhaust the amount of enthusiasm that you have in it, because that's the one thing that I think is all too easy for game masters to forget is, what are you going to do for the fifth session of this campaign?
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing wrong with doing a one-shot campaign just for the fun of it. I mean, there are a lot of my ideas that probably would have worked a lot better as just one shot and then done. But, you know, I think I think most of us have at least start with the ambition of doing something long term. And I think that's one of the crucial tests that you have to pass before you pursue it any further. Now, to answer your question about things that I have pitched that I just could not convince my players on. Okay, I still think this is one of the coolest things ever. Okay, I desperately wanted to do World War I superheroes.
Yeah.
Because to me, what's the only thing cooler than superheroes? Superheroes with Zeppelins.
Yeah, totally.
And
you love those Zeppelins, don't you? You're always talking about them.
If you don't love Zeppelins, you have no reason reading comics.
Well, yeah, there you go. Well, I mean, it's part of my general fascination with failed technology. There's an archetype. There's an archetype in Golden Age where the retro gadgeteer.
Yeah.
And it's just basically a guy who his entire motif is technology that was dead by 1950 at the latest.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember his pull quote is, quick to the auto gyro. We're going to save that Zeppelin using the miracle of radio.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't own an iPod, so that's a character. I still have CDs, so that's a character I identify with far too much. But anyway, World 1 Supers never got anything other than crickets and blank stares from the greatest group of players that any game master had ever had. They followed me down every single other rabbit hole I ever pitched to them, but that's the one that never got anywhere.
I would love to do a World War I Supers game, but I've tried to run similar ideas, and I notice that whenever I get around to that time period, that pulp adventure time period, unless you say Indiana Jones, people really don't have a lot of context for it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's something that only some of us have enough, I guess, historical background on it to really appreciate the setting, the genre.
So you must have seen me standing in my living room going, come on, Doughboys. Doughboys.
Yeah.
Nothing.
The biggest challenge that I can think of that I had that was like this was when I was trying to pitch Arthur Lives to my players. And the trouble was not that the concept was hard to understand, because the idea of Arthurian characters reincarnated in the present was super easy for anyone to get a hold of.
Yeah.
But rather that they felt, oh, well, I'm not really interested in King Arthur, so I don't think I'll have fun. And what I struggled to get across to them is that you don't have to make the stereotypical Arthurian knight in order to play this game. In fact, the whole point of the game is to embrace crazy ideas of what if Arthur was a girl, or what if Lancelot was, you know, a district attorney, or, you know, what, just whatever, you know, to try and be as, what if Merlin was a voodoo hungan, you know, whatever kind of crazy idea you want to play with, try, you know, take that out for a spin. I'm not just because it's Arthur doesn't mean I'm requiring some kind of fidelity to anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard to get across, that you don't really have any limits other than the fact that your character was alive during Arthur's reign. Other than that, you can do whatever you want.
I think that's actually one of the stumbling blocks that players can sometimes hit. Is when you give them something and you say, well, there's no limits. Sometimes they'll balk at that because they don't.
Yeah.
Limits help them make choices.
Yeah. For me, when it comes time for me to create a campaign,
mm-hmm.
for me, I have to have a hook that makes me really want to run it. My last M&M campaign was called POTUS. And the players were all Secret Service agents during the last presidential election. And they were the Secret Service team for the Republican nominee for president. And that was the campaign. And I ran it during the nomination process.
Neat.
The first episode was the Republican National Convention. And I held it on the night of the Republican National Convention. And then we played once a week until election night. And that was the campaign. And
wow,
it was
neat.
Yeah, it was. It was really neat. And it was I struggled with it at first because I was like, okay, well, I knew I wanted to link it into current events and the idea that we would have like this, that the Republican nominee for president was not John McCain, but was rather a former superhero who had lost his powers and was now the governor of New Jersey. And I struggled with, like, for example, my first decision was like, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to make the players like Barack Obama's Secret Service team, or do I want to make them, do I want them to be the protecting the Democrat or protecting the Republican? And I had to figure out which one would make a better story.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided, well, Barack Obama was already history making because he's the first black guy. So I wouldn't want to replace him. So if I was going to have a superhero candidate, he would have to be the Republican nominee. And he really would have made a better Republican nominee anyway, because superheroes are traditionally perceived of as kind of a conservative icon. So, you know, characters like Green Arrow accepted,
mm-hmm.
they're generally seen as fairly status quo characters. So then making them, and also because I'm as liberal as they come, I'm like super liberal man. So making the heroes protect a guy, which I would undoubtedly paint as a complete jerk, created more story hooks than having them protect a guy who was sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when I pitched the idea, it was pretty easy to get a hold of, and my players were all very politically conscious anyway, so they were like, oh yeah, you know, let me at that game. And the fact that it was limited, the fact that it was only going to run for 10 weeks, made it attractive to players who were otherwise very busy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that campaign was very successful and was a lot of fun. But it started with that pitch, and I didn't know who the bad guy was in that game until about week six.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I let the players sort of figure out who the bad guy was. I set the campaign in my Powers That Be setting, which is the setting that we – no, I set it in the – the field guide, the setting that the field guide to superheroes is set in.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean, the Worlds of Wonder setting.
Uh-huh.
It was set in the Worlds of Wonder. And so I knew the setting really, really well. So whenever the players wanted to do something, I could pull up an NPC to answer that. So when some player says, well, what do I know about time travel? I could tell him, well, you know about this guy who's called the Temp, and he claims to be the guy in charge of monitoring time, and I had all that material. And so when they decided to time travel to try to figure out what the bad guy was doing, all those tools were there in the campaign. This is, you know, anyone who's run a campaign for a long time already has all these tools. My players hadn't done that, but I had enough setting that I had all the tools handy for them.
Mm-hmm.
The villain of that campaign basically ended up being Karl Rove. not the real Karl Rove, but the Republican candidate's campaign manager was secretly using time travel to go back and rerun the campaign after he lost. And so what happened is the Republican nominee lost the election, but then the campaign manager had a stolen time machine, and he would go back, you know, a couple of weeks or a month or 2 months or 3 months to do the campaign all over again. And he had actually done this over 100 times, losing every single time. And the players were the characters in like the 100th iteration of this. None of this was known to me or the players until we all sort of discovered it together about, well, they didn't figure it out until the last session, but I had to figure it out about a month before that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So basically, I think we all agree that we like to rely on pre-published materials to some degree for you know, shoring up a game. Like, you know, in your case, you're talking about you know, a setting that you'd already developed in another game. You know, when I say pre-published, I don't necessarily mean by somebody else, but something that you already have existing, you know, material for. But you know, again, actually tapping into, you know, something that somebody else has written is certainly not a sign of weakness.
It's often
a very efficacious way to facilitate your own story, to really, you know, not have to focus on the nitty gritty, but you can concentrate on the storytelling you want to do. But how often do you guys find success in a game where you actually build the entire, you know, an entire campaign out of whole cloth, and run it without tapping into those kind of resources? I mean, is that something that you find you have less success running a campaign where you have less preparation, or is your success more dependent on other factors?
Well, like I said, I was always very, very tough on myself for coming up with ideas that had a lot of legs and a lot of longevity to them. And, I think I wound up throwing out like 5 or 7 ideas I really loved for every one that I actually went ahead and ran.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that I actually ran tended to just go on forever. You know, I had a 3-year-long Twilight 2000 campaign. I ran Star Trek, the role-playing game, for 5 years.
Wow.
I had a
5-year mission.
Indeed I did.
Wow.
I had a Champions game that evolved into Noir that I ran for 2 years twice a week with 2 different groups.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, with the exception of the Trek thing, which, you know, it ran on so long, it almost sort of built its own little parallel universe that just every now and again would coincidentally touch upon what was happening on the movies and the TV series. You know, for me, it was just always following my own little mad vision wherever it went. And, I mean, no writer comes with anything completely original, but, you know, I was always looking for outside the box stuff to kind of plug back into my pre-existing campaign. And, you know, for better or for worse, you know, hey, what if old film noir movies had superheroes in them? You know, as many people as hated that book, I will at least give myself credit for trying something that hadn't been done before.
You and keep that saying that, but I have yet to find somebody who hated that book.
Oh, well, maybe they just all left the internet at once in a huff, but seriously, that's the only time the internet has made me cry was the reaction to that book.
I honestly can't say I've ever found anybody who really didn't. I've found a lot of people who said, hey, that's a really cool idea, but I wouldn't run it. But you know, which is a perfectly valid, you
sure,
know, thing to say. Yeah. But I've never actually sent anyone that, you know, or had anyone say that was not a well written book or that was a poorly thought out book.
Oh, go back to the RPGNet archives from December 2005 on and see how many worst M&M book ever threads that are just there's 75 responses and all they say is noir.
Wow.
Well, James, to get back to your question about our use of outside material and as opposed to games which are completely sort of self-created, I certainly have found that in this era where time is more and more precious as we get older, that I'm less inclined to run games where I have to do all the prep myself.
Mm-hmm.
The last campaign that I ran was a Fate campaign. A science fiction campaign of my own design. And I had been running D&D 4th edition for 3 years. And the beauty of running D&D is that you never have to do any work that you don't want to. You know, you can pull in adventures and entire world settings and character classes and chunky bits or whatever. There's all that work is done for you. It's a wonderfully well-supported game. But Fate was precisely the opposite. There's no support, almost no support for it at all. Not even a single edition of the rules which I could give to my players. I had to create a wiki that explained what house rules we were using and how to make characters. And I created the entire setting and I had to create everything myself. And I loved the game, and my players really enjoyed it because they felt like they had a lot more involvement in the setting. You know, this was not a game that anybody else in the world was running. This was our Fate game.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent 2 hours prepping for every 1 hour of actual gameplay.
Right.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, I love running the game, but to run that game for 5 hours, I had to spend 10 hours of research and making up characters and figuring out plots and fleshing out the setting, and it turned into a chore.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really wish was, even if there had been basic tools, like if there had been, you know, an antagonist's book that I could plunder villains from, or if there had been a spaceships book that I could pull stats out of, even if I wasn't using anybody else's setting, just something that I could pull stat blocks out of would have made that game run so much better. For those people that are listening and they're thinking, well, I want to create my setting from the ground up, you know, don't let me dissuade you from doing it. By all means, do that. But because it's a wonderfully rewarding experience, but it does take a lot of time, and you've got to have the guts to put that much time into it. You know, one of the best lessons I learned for this was from an old Dragon magazine column, which was, look, only invent the stuff that you know your players are going to need the first session, and then just expand it a little bit at a time as you need to. And of course, this is again for a D&D campaign where you have a lot more control over where the players go and who they interact with than you do in a superheroes game.
Right.
In a superheroes game, the players can fly to another city in one panel. But in a D&D game, they're kind of restricted in terms of travel and movement, and also because of the structure of the campaign. And by that, I mean level.
Right.
In a D&D game, the players are first level, and their concerns are first level concerns. In a Champions game or a Mutants and Masterminds game, the players they're already so powerful that it's so unpredictable as far as like who they're going to want to interact with. But if you know, for example, that one of your characters is a cop, then you've got to give him a partner and a boss and almost anything else other than a partner and a lieutenant that hates them. Right. You can hand wave until episode 2.
Right.
So don't knock yourself out inventing things that you don't need yet, because you'll have plenty of work to do just trying to cover the mandatory bases.
And another great thing about following that advice is regardless of what genre you're running in, the less you plan, the less you're going to find that you're unintentionally railroading your players.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because it's just human nature that if you spend 14 hours building up a city or a planet or a dimension or whatever, your players don't choose not to go there, you're gonna twist your campaign reality as much as it takes to get them to that thing you put all that work into. And that's no fun for anybody.
You know, the best example of this that I have found in gaming is the romantic interest. Lots of players like romantic interests. Some players like having romantic interests, and I'm somewhat of a sucker for them myself, and so I tend to put them into my games as a GM. But you can't force a player to have a romantic interest in a particular NPC. You just can't. And the more, in some senses, the more you try to force it, the less satisfying it is.
I have to say one of my the most fun campaigns I ever ran was a fantasy game. This goes back years, but one of those moments that this just brings up was one of these scenarios where I had, I started off the game with the players, you know, basically coming from our world to this fantasy world, and they rescued a princess that was being, you know, in the process of being kidnapped. And, they managed to escort her to the first town. And they, you know, they actually rescued her and her entourage.
Yeah.
So, of course, the intention was for, you know, them to be introduced to the city politics through this princess and her brother, and everything. And the princess was supposed to be a romantic interest for one of the heroes.
Yeah.
And what happens? The hero falls in love with the handmaiden.
Right. And that's exactly the... This is how I learned, you know, to do this is instead of creating one romantic interest, just introduce plenty of single or at least interesting male and female characters, and keep your ears tuned for when the players express interest. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly that character's personality between this episode and the next becomes much more fleshed out.
Right.
Right? So, okay, this player wants to spend time with that NPC. I'll spend 2 hours giving that character a backstory that he didn't have before the player expressed interest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's totally right. I mean, if your focus is on just coming up with interesting characters that you're excited about playing as a GM, you know, your players will do the rest. I'm probably going to get some yays and some yucks when I say this, but every single campaign that I ran had at least one wedding in there somewhere between a player and an NPC. Sure. And I never had any preconceptions or pre-planning about who was going to wind up with who. And it was a constant surprise. And it made so much more fun for me just to see how this is a character I enjoy playing. Let's see how the characters react to this. And, it kept the surprise for the GM. And really, when you're the one that knows everything, if you're being surprised by the results, I think you're really onto something special there.
Yeah, totally. You know, as advice to new GMs out there, or GMs that are designing a setting, figure out what kind of important themes or tone or questions that you want to pose or how you want the campaign to feel, and try not to sweat the little details of the plot so much. Let the players feel, because you'll have plenty of fun figuring out your campaign, you want your campaign to be about sacrifice. Okay, so you're designing your next adventure and you start putting some opportunities for the players to make sacrifices into it, you'll get your kicks out of that. And rather than trying to force them to do a particular thing or even glorify a particular character or a particular subplot, you know, let the subplots fall where they may, and the players will love you for it. They'll love you to have that feeling of agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that freedom to act. And one of the things that I liked about, I was looking over the Dresden Files role playing game recently, and one of the things I really liked about the collaborative approach to world building that it takes is that it encourages, you know, the players to each come up with a location in the setting and tie that location and then a person in that location to either one of the major themes of the campaign or one of the major threats of the campaign. Yeah. So, you know, that thematic approach, I think sometimes we do it unconsciously, especially when I'm just kind of just sitting down, let's do a superhero games. You know, I kind of have these preconceptions about what I think superhero heroic themes are.
Yeah.
So I kind of have those in the back of my head, but you know, when I sit down and do something like a fantasy campaign or something, I really want to sit down and think out, well, what kind of story arcs do I want to tell? What themes do I want to bring out? What mood do I want the campaign? You know, do I want this to be serious and dramatic, or do I want to make it, you know, more lighthearted and silly, and really try to create the elements of the setting that I know I'm going to need right off the bat, you know, some opposition for the characters initially and some, you know, some facilitating NPCs to help them figure out what they're supposed to do. And the rest of it just, you know, I try to get the players to contribute as much as possible from their side of things, you know, how they want their background to shape out, how, you know, who is important to them that brings them into the scenario. Like, you know, a character may be a knight in service to a king. Well, in that case, you know, I want that player to tell me, well, what kind of king does he serve? You know, is this a good king, or is this a frustrating position for an honorable knight serving a corrupt king? You know, what kind of background do you want? And I try to encourage the players to contribute as much as possible to the setting.
What I have found is that this is one of those situations in which the game system is more important than perhaps we at first think.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to get into a mentality where a system is just a system, that every system can be used to run every game. And I went through a long phase where I was all for like generic game systems like Hero System and GURPS and any system which can be used to sort of simulate any genre. But maybe I've just gotten older, but I've come to rather to see now that systems kind of lend themselves to different forms of campaign creation. And when you're playing Fate in Dresden Files, or you're playing a game like Ars Magica, for example, which is another one where you create the setting in a particular session. All the players get together, and you decide what your covenant is going to be like in Ars Magica. That if the system requires that, it invites you to do that. You're not required to do that in M&M. And M&M is much more of a kind of, I'm not saying that you wouldn't take in the players' perspectives, but it's much more of a single GM kind of artistic vision sort of system where the GM decides what levers and switches he's going to flip and where he's going to set the dial for power level. And the GM comes up with a concept and sort of pitches it like you first described at the beginning of our podcast. Okay, we're going to run a World War II supers game, except their aliens have conquered the Earth. And you just sort of, you know, pitch it out there, and it keeps more of the control of the campaign settings in the GM's hands. I'm not saying one is better than the other, but I
agree with that. To some degree, I agree with that because, you know, one of the driving factors of a game system like Mutants and Masterminds is that the opposition has an unknown quality to it. That there's, you know, of course you don't know, you know, what the numbers are on the other side of the Game Master screen,
right,
as it were.
That's right.
And then there are systems like Bash where there are no secrets, you know, where you actually tell your players and you play everything out in the open.
Yeah.
So just within the superhero genre, you have, you know, some two examples there that will give you a very different feel when playing them and,
yeah.
you know, how you treat NPCs.
Yeah, that's good. Chris, what do you think?
It's all great stuff. I'm busy taking notes.
what do you think about the role of systems on the campaign sort of feel itself? I mean, are you a system specific to the genre guy, or are you a generic system guy?
You know, we in the campaigns that run, we just tended to use whatever system occurred to us first. That was maybe the least amount of imagination that we put into it. Like, for instance, yeah. you know, the campaign that became Noir, it was originally a Champions game.
Yep.
And don't get me wrong, I love Champions. I still do Champions characters for fun because I'm a geek. Yeah. And because it's a great system, and my buddies Steve and Darren and Jason and all the great people at Hero have taken a great thing and made it even better.
I've played the hell out of Champions in college especially, although I have to admit that once M&M came out, I haven't really done much with it.
Yeah, but here's the thing, okay? So I'm running this game that's only like one third combat.
Yeah,
and I could just never escape. You know, why exactly am I using this really, really, really heavy duty, detailed combat system when mostly it's just character interaction? It always seemed like, I had great players, we made it work, but you know, it just, that was the system at hand. We used it. We went ahead and did what we wanted to do and what we felt we needed to do.
Yeah,
and yeah, so. You know, system's never really been a big consideration for me. Although I will say this much, the art of game design has gotten so much better in just the last few years.
You think so?
Let me give a shout out for what the guys did with Spirit of the Century.
Oh, you know, sure.
That's the first time in my life I've ever wanted to run a game just for the system.
Mm.
You know, to me, it was like, how can I take this system and adapt it to things it was never meant to do?
Well, that's Fate, of course, and it is a great system. I have to confess, when we held the player character creation session for my Fate space game, when that session was over, one of the guys looked to me and he said, "I love this game."
Absolutely,
he felt so much a part of the campaign. And it was a direct contrast to D&D, where players don't make any major decisions about the campaign setting for D&D.
Exactly.
I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah.
You know, the DM creates the world, or he pulls up Greyhawk or Forgotten or whatever, and he just dumps you in a tavern and says, okay, you know, orcs.
Yeah, and that's how it was for me. I was a guy who got hooked on worlds.
Yeah.
You know, I have a long, 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 long love of Shadowrun.
Yes.
I've loved Shadowrun since first edition. And again, a game that's gotten massively better over the years. Mm. But if you loved Shadowrun during the first edition, you loved it in spite of the system. I'm sorry, great people worked on that game. It was a big hit. It was still one of my favorites. But definitely first edition, you loved it in spite of those rules.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have my first edition Shadowrun book on the shelf.
Yeah.
Jed Greenwood cover.
Yeah, I mean, it was a game that totally got by on just the sheer awesomeness of the concept and how well executed it was.
Yeah, and the rabidness of the fans.
Oh, well, how could you not get rabid over that idea? I'm sorry. That's one of the all-time great gaming ideas for me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
and it's the only thing that could overcome the wretchedness of that first edition system. I'm sorry. I got to tell the truth, brothers and sisters, but that's how it was.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I've over the years, it's kind of funny because I don't know whether it's a lack of imagination or simply an impatience with rule systems in general, but I've always tended to gravitate towards, you know, using one system for everything. I think it's mainly just a lack of wanting to waste time with rules when I want to focus on the storytelling.
Yeah,
so exactly. once I've found a system that I know how to run and I feel is I feel comfortable bending to my will, I'll usually stick with that for a decade or two.
Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons to keep one system. I mean, quite frankly, a lot of players don't want to learn a new system.
Mm-hmm.
I love reading game books. You know, I will happily buy a campaign setting and read it just to read it and enjoy seeing what other people have done. And the more I write these sorts of books, the more I come to understand the incredible number of man hours that go into them. And, so I will happily read a new book and learn a new rule set and everything. But a lot of people aren't as thirsty as us.
James, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you've also hit upon another thing that I think that's really gotten better about this industry is one of the great lessons I learned as a professional from Shane Hensley was whatever you're writing, make it fun to read.
Yes.
And I just think that like the readability of game products has gone up so much in recent years, you know, and I mean, more than ever, I find myself reading, game books, not because I ever even plan on running the system, just because you admire the craft and the creativity that's gone into some of the best stuff that's out there.
There's really good stuff out there. And it's wonderful because it sets great goalposts for people like you and me, you know, who – we're writing this stuff, but man, everybody else is so damn good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to say that, comprehension is definitely a lot easier with some games. You know, you definitely spot a game that doesn't rise to that level very quickly. And it's very hard for me to invest in something if it's a chore to learn.
Yeah.
If it's easy to learn and easy to play, I will adapt very quickly and focus on the storytelling. But if I have trouble trying to get past that initial hurdle, I'll get frustrated very easily and want to do something else.
Yeah.
Because I want to get to the fun part, which for me is, of course, the role-playing and, you know, playing cool, awesome character. Or as the GM, you know, setting the stage for the players to do the same thing. So for me, the rules are at their best when they're not getting in the way. And that comes as early as trying to figure out how they work. You know, if it's a chore to learn them, then it's not going to be fun to play them.
I guess I just really sort of brought up rule systems in general because there are some games that the rules empower that game to do things that are unique to that game. And maybe it's because I'm in an occasional Ars Magica campaign right now that's kind of on my mind. But Ars Magica is famous in role-playing as supposedly it has the best magic system ever made. And this is its sort of claim to fame. And it's set in the medieval period in a sort of magical, but historically accurate Middle Ages. And yes, in theory, you could do that with any game. You could set, okay, you're all wizards in the 12th century, and you belong to this order that's divided into 12 houses, and here's your history and everything. But the way that magic works in the physical system of the game permeates through it in so many directions that it influences everything in the setting and how wizards learn magic and how they manage their magical resources and how they practice it and what their ultimate goals are and how they age and finally fade into sort of magical coma. All of it's bound up with the game system. And yes, you could use any system to tell that story. But why bother when there's a system that's designed around that story?
Mm-hmm.
Another much smaller example is something like Dogs in the Vineyard. Isn't that a great game?
Oh, awesome game.
Now, you could use any game system to tell that story, but it's got these wonderfully elegant mechanics that do it for you. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been kind of isolated from the gaming environment. It's kind of unusual how I found myself thrust into the position that I'm at now, but I spent a number of years kind of moving around the country and writing in a little vacuum. So I would, you know, write my own game systems and ran my own stuff because I was just never happy with what was on the shelf at the time. And, you know, coming back into a larger gaming environment where I started going to conventions again and making connections and looking and seeing what was on the market at the time, I discovered that I'd traveled down a parallel evolution with what other people had been doing with game systems and, you know, seeing some new ideas that I hadn't come up with. I kind of started devouring game books again and running around and just, you know, I would buy something even if I heard bad reviews, you know, if it had one or two interesting ideas in it that I wanted to, you know, maybe keep on the shelf to reference later and possibly adapt to something. So it was the past, I think 10 years, I've seen a lot of kind of exciting things as far as new approaches to gaming. I think Fate is a good example of a very novel approach to gaming that is, you know, again, it's one of a kind of a new breed of games. I think I really have to say it kind of started with White Wolf as far as popularity goes, but it, narrative-driven games. You know, it was like White Wolf seemed like it was the odd man out for a long time. I didn't see any other games that kind of followed its lead until recently when Fate and a couple of other similar games. And Cortex, the Margaret Weiss Productions, their game systems tend to follow a very narrative line of thinking, although they have a very strategic approach with the dice sometimes. But you have a very narrative focus on character creation and how they affect the story, which is one of the, you know, again, using the system, you know, if you tried to tell a story like Smallville, whether you're a fan of the show or not, if you tried to tell a story like that with Mutants and Masterminds, you'd have one very happy player who had lots of powers and a bunch of other players who are really annoyed that, you know, they didn't really get to do much. Whereas with the actual system that Margaret Weiss Productions came up with for the Smallville role-playing game, you know, Clark is no more influential on the story than Chloe. They have different ways of contributing to the narrative. And that, to me, is probably the most exciting thing about, you know, different systems is when they put the focus on different aspects of the game and allow you to tell stories that would otherwise, you know, like Mutants and Masterminds, a common thread that pops up on the Atomic Think Tank is how do you tell a story with characters like the Justice League where you have, you know, somebody like Green Arrow who's power level 10 and Superman who's power level 15 or whatever, fighting side by side. How do you do that in a gaming environment? And there are several answers. But it really kind of shows up that that's not what the system is really designed for. You know, this system, you know, the power level system is designed to kind of create a sense of fair play among players. It's you know, and give the GM some benchmarks for challenges. So it's not really designed around the idea of creating a diverse power level team.
If I can speak up for the people that sign my paychecks for just a second.
Please do.
and no disrespect to what the wonderful people at Margaret Weiss are doing. You know, we had to get into this mixed level power thing. I had to address it in Golden Age and Silver Age because goodness knows the most visible thing in Golden Age is the JSA where the Spectre and the, you know, Wildcat are on the scene.
My favorite example is from the Avengers where you have Tigra and Thor.
And honestly, it's really just to me it's no harder than keeping in mind at all times the special capabilities of your characters, because if you keep in mind that, you know, characters that are going to be ostensibly lower powered are also going to be skill heavy, there's going to be things that they can do that higher level characters simply aren't going to be able to do. Now, it's a little more work than if everybody is in that Superman range of power, but I don't think it's as impossible as some people think it is.
Certainly not impossible, and that wasn't my intent, but it does put more work, and the work goes on the shoulders of the GM in this case for the most part, because he has to plan scenarios with the idea that he's got to give opportunities for the different characters to each have a chance to really do what they do.
Did you guys ever play DC Heroes?
That's true, but you're also I'm sorry. Just let me get into something
real
quick.
Yeah, sure.
You know, but you're not dealing with a problem that comic book writers haven't been dealing with since, you know, All-Star Comics number 3 came out. You know, and if you've got a group that is looking for those comic book tropes, to me, that's part of pleasing them. That's coming up with adventures that are like JLA adventures where everybody gets to contribute. And to me, that's just part of doing that extra work to make sure your audience goes home happy. So, I mean, I don't think it to be an especially onerous or unusual burden if like I said, your first priority is to please your audience and give them those comic book tropes that they want.
Right.
Did you guys ever play DC Heroes?
Absolutely.
The Mayfair or the Wegg version?
The first version.
The Mayfair.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's talking about...
They put out a Justice League Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember it.
Oh, yeah.
They had to deal with this problem. You've got Aquaman, Hawkman, Green Arrow, and then you have Superman and Wonder Woman. And this is pre-crisis. Superman.
Oh, God.
So he had like a strength of 50.
Right.
And so then you have to come up with a villain group that can challenge these characters. And it was, well, quite frankly, every single member of the villain group either had kryptonite or magic. so that Superman would be threatened, because otherwise he would beat them all up in one round using a multi-attack.
But to be fair, isn't that pretty much every Superman story for that era? I mean, the only thing you're really missing is a guy with red kryptonite.
Yeah, well, usually what would happen is you would come up with some reason to separate Superman from the rest of the team.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a giant meteor buzzing for the planet, and Superman has to go stop it while everybody else fights the villains. Right?
Oh, yeah. But again, you know, if your audience is looking for those kind of comic book tropes, that's just part of delivering what they want.
Mm-hmm. I do think that it takes a special kind of group to accept highly different power levels amongst the players.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. It's not something that I myself would do. But like I said, you know, if you're an audience that just want that they want to be the JLA every single week, that's just part of making them happy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's something that's taken in, you know, you need to take into consideration when you're choosing a system for a game is, you know, why you're choosing that system. I mean, for me, when I choose, and again, my normal system, the system I gravitate to for 99% of my gaming is Mutants and Masterminds. It's just, you know, what I know. Yeah. It's what I'm comfortable with. I can create characters very quickly. Yeah. And, you know, I can fudge characters very easily. You know, I can go, well, I need a criminal, and, you know, I need to stall the players for this long, so he has to be this power level, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And just kind of figure it out what it is, but the reason I kind of gravitate to Mutants and Masterminds is that, one, it grants a certain level of tactical depth on how the system functions. You have the interplay between the ability scores and the advantages and the powers in such a way that you have a lot of clever things that you can do within those rules. And, you know, they set a framework for, you know, the give and take of combat. And, you know, that for me is a really strong reason why I like that system.
The very mechanic of extra effort and hero points.
Yeah. And again, that was one of the selling points for me when I was picking up the book and looking through it. It's kind of funny. The first time somebody showed me the rule book, I looked at it and said, oh, I flipped through it and I said, oh, character classes, and I put it down.
Right.
I because I saw these archetypes and I'm like, and they were named after the archetype as opposed to, and I'm just like, oh, character classes. And I just put it down and I saw levels, the word levels. And I just said, oh,
right.
God, no. And I put it down. And I just said, nah. And
I'm sorry.
And then about 6 months later, I picked it up in a bookstore because I was bored and I was flipping through it and going, oh, wait, this is completely different from what I thought.
Yeah.
Can I tell you a quick funny story?
Yeah.
Okay. The last Gen Con we did before Mutants and Masterminds actually released, all we had was the poster up in the booth of the original cover art.
Mm-hmm.
Hand to God, this happened. A gamer came up to our booth, looked me square in the eye, and said, D20 Supers, really? Really? And walked off.
Is that what he thought it was going to be?
Well, I mean that's how we. I mean, we were promoting the game that this is. I think it was originally even promoted as being a D20 with D20 logo superhero system. It wasn't until like right very late in the process that it went from being straight D20 to being OGL.
I see.
Right. But you know, the fact that, you know, we had the cover and a one-line ad blurb, and already people thought this was the worst thing ever created.
Oh, I see.
We were history's greatest monsters right there. Just on the poster art and the ad line. And, you know, so, I mean, the fact that it actually went on to become as big a hit as it was, that has not erased that memory from my mind one little bit.
Well, it's a wonderful game. I love it, and I have run it many, many times. And my current M&M concept, which I have not yet been able to run, and it might be an interesting and educational story, is called The Jury. And the idea is very simple. All the player characters are doing jury duty, and they all get powers at the same time. And that's my hook. And the beauty of it was that the players can make any character they want that would be able to serve jury duty.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you can't be a policeman, right? And you can't be under 16 or under 18 or whatever. But if you can be in this room, then you can get powers. But then I ran into exactly the problem that Chris talked about at the beginning of our podcast. I was like, okay, and then what?
right.
And then what? And I realized, well, I have to have, you know, a major plot. And I figured out, okay, so clearly there's some sort of plot going on that involves the trial. Like, you know, the guy who's on trial and the defense attorney and the judge and the witnesses, and they're all part of this conspiracy or plot that the players are also a part of, but they don't know it. But then I was like, yeah, but okay, so that gives me an overarching plot line, but I couldn't decide everything else in the game world, and what are they going to do in between story arc missions? And I floundered and said, ah, screw it. I'll go work on King Arthur instead.
Well, listen, before we finish up, there is one other little bit of wisdom. Feel free to put wisdom in sneer quotes if you want, that I wanted to pass along on this topic. And it's actually one of the things I've realized that has served me well in my game design and game master career. And that is, if you're dealing with the superhero genre, again, there are going to be people that just want to be the X-Men every week.
Yep.
But if you have players who have any kind of appetite for anything other than hitting the same five notes every single story,
yeah.
If you sort of – oh, God, and I hate using this word. If you sort of deconstruct the hero genre just a bit and think of it in these terms, essentially what you're doing is you're talking about people that are special in some way. And if you think about how virtually every single story – that's ever been written is about a protagonist that's unusual to some degree. If you think about superheroes as being pieces that you can fit into basically any other piece of literature that's ever been created, it opens up this great storytelling vista to you beyond just, hey, here's my Days of Future Past ripoff setting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I mean, it's led me down some wonderful, 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 you know, campaign rabbit holes, if you will. But, you know, I'm the guy who did Civil War Supers, yep. And, you know, just so many off the wall things for and God bless Green Ronin for letting me do them.
Mm-hmm.
But there you go. I just wanted to pass that along. And it sounded like it dovetailed very nicely with the thesis of your book, sir. So maybe this is a topic you could speak to better than I could.
Oh, I don't know about that. But we may be out of time. Don't get me started on my book when we only have 2 minutes left.
Oh, sorry.
Give me a paper cut and pour lemon juice on it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So actually, this has been a really fun conversation. I was wondering if you guys might want to try and – pick it up again in the near future. We could,
yeah, you know, maybe we could talk about, maybe we could take it a step further on, or maybe we could try to actually come up with some kind of setting, you know, between us, or maybe we could, I don't know, there's all kinds of ways we could go. Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay. Would you be up for that?
Oh, sure, as long as we do World War One Supers.
Yeah. It's decided.
Christopher, if you're running, I'll pick up the dice anytime I'll play.
Oh, God bless you, sir. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much for joining me tonight. I think I always love talking to you guys because I always get a new perspective on things. And, you know, it's always a pleasure for me. So hopefully we can schedule another session and jam. And actually, I think next time what might be cool is to actually specifically talk about, you know, make the assumption that we have a session or setting and then talk about how you construct an adventure for your players.
Yeah.
That might be a fun way to do it. We'll have to email each other and discuss what we'd like to do. But
you bet.
All right. So I guess rather than keep Jason any... actually, both of you guys up any later on a school night, since you're both teachers.
Yeah,
I'm glad you threw that in because you're going to make it sound like we're all about to be grounded.
Well, you know, I mean, I never told people how old you are, so or how young you are.
You shall not.
But well, thank you guys very, very much for stopping in tonight. I really appreciate it, and I hope we can do this again soon. But until next time, stay vigilant.